In the matter of Henry Sanchez versus Fitness Factory Edgewater LLC, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. Andrew Wolf from the Wolf Law Firm on behalf of Fitness Factory, appellant and Mr. Class A.
Good morning, Your Honor. Darren Gazarian from the New Jersey Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Amicus Department of Health and Insurance.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Ronald Faisal from the ESA Canadian and Gian Tomasi on behalf of the respondents.
Welcome, counsel. And I'm sorry to say this at the outset, we will probably not run straight through. We're going to break at around 12:30 or at a good break spot based on the arguments, and then we'll pick up after a half hour. Mr. Wolf.
I guess I have to say good afternoon. I like the voice. Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, again, Andrew Wolf on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Sanchez, and the putative class. I'd also like to reserve a few minutes at the end for rebuttal, please.
That's fine.
All right.
Would you mind just keeping your voice up a bit?
I think that's the third time you've told me that. I'll try to
Sorry. It's probably my
Actually,
hearing and
not
your speak.
The third time you've told me that.
Okay.
But I will try. I usually
All right.
speak loud.
It's because I want to hear what you have to say.
I understand completely, Your Honor. So I'm going to start with a little anecdote. Yesterday was my seven-year-old little eight-pound apricot shih-poo's birthday, and her name happens to be Risa. When we adopted her a little over 7 years ago, she came with that name, and it's kind of apropos that the day after her seventh birthday, I'm here arguing the applicability of the Risa statute. We
well,
didn't change her
it's,
name.
Lawyers should name their dogs after statutes.
But I didn't. She came with that name. Anyway, just a little levity to begin the argument,
okay.
Which always makes me more
comfortable.
Tell us
about Millet. There are a lot of dogs named Lad, and they're all named after statues.
That's true. Anyway, so I think it's important here, and I want to make my opening statement regarding, I guess, the last holding in the appellate division, which was that it said the contract here wasn't a true retail installment contract because there was no financing agreement. I'm also going to slightly disagree with Amicus, the Department of Banking and Insurance, on that issue. Because I think it's clear, and I'll explain to you why through my analysis, why a financing agreement, one, is a misnomer, and two, there's no requirement for a time, price, differential, finance charge, or interest in order for there to be a retail installment contract under New Jersey law. And the I guess the misapplication goes back to the 1978 decision in the Girard Acceptance Corporation case, where the court there said that acts including RESA are part of a package of laws designed to protect consumers from overreaching by others, to protect consumers from overextending their own resources, and also to promote the availability of financing to purchase various goods and services. So financing in and of itself doesn't connote a finance charge, and I'm going to explain why in more detail, but financing, all it means is like extending credit, which is to defer payment over time and not to actually require a finance charge to be part of that agreement. And where do I get that? Let's go first to the Retail Installment Sales Act. Under the Retail Installment Sales Act, the definition, as is all in the briefs, of a retail installment contract doesn't mention a time price differential or finance charge at all. It actually just says it's a contract other than a retail charge account or an instrument reflecting the sale pursuant thereto and entered into in this state between a retail seller and a retail buyer, evidencing an agreement to pay the retail purchase price of goods or services which are primarily for personal, family, or household purposes, or any part thereof in two or more installments over a period of time. We can go through the rest of the definitions. It then talks about a retail charge account. And under that, after it says what it is, it says, and under which the unpaid balance thereafter, whenever incurred, is payable in one or more installments, and under which a time price differential may be added in each billing period provided in here. May. It doesn't say it has to be. It says it may. But more importantly, let's go to Section 41 of the Retail Installment Sales Act, which is entitled Time Price Differential Rates Computation. In the introductory clause of Section 41 of the Retail Installment Sales Act, it says a retail seller and a motor vehicle installment seller under the provisions of this act shall have authority to charge, contract for, receive, or collect a time price differential as defined in this act, or any retail installment contract evidencing the sale of goods or services in an amount or amounts as agreed to by the retail seller or motor vehicle installment seller and the buyer or motor vehicle and on all other grounds or goods or services. Important to note under that also that or services was added in 1971. It wasn't in the original statute. It was in the original definition of what a retail installment sales contract, but in what a price differential, services were added to that by amendment in 1971. And that brings me to an analysis with the Federal Truth in Lending Act. So we all know that RESA was enacted in 1960, along with a lot of other states. The federal government, 8 years later in 1968, enacted the Federal Truth in Lending Act, which was a comprehensive statutory scheme affecting finance sales and other issues. In 1969, the year after the Truth in Lending Act was enacted, the New Jersey legislature enacted NJSA 17:3B-1 regarding truth in lending, inconsistent state provisions, and it was acted in 1969. And it included a whole bunch of financing agreements in New Jersey law, including the Retail Installment Sales Act, and it declared that the extent that the provisions of any of the following New Jersey laws are inconsistent with respect to disclosure, advertising, terminology, type size, method of computation of finance short charges, form, content, or time of delivery provisions and requirements of the Truth in Lending Act, and any regulations issued pursuant to their compliance with said federal laws and regulations shall be deemed construed to be compliance with the specifically related provisions of the statutes, including the Retail Installment Sales Act. And if we go and look at the Truth in Lending Act, it has definitions and it has procedures as well in both the statute itself and in Regulation Z, which are the federal regulations that talk about that. And they talk about what a credit is. Credit, like a financing agreement, means the right granted by a creditor to a debtor to defer payment of debt or to incur debt and defer its payment. Doesn't say anything about charging a finance charge or a time price differential. Then it says what a creditor is. And a creditor refers only to a person who both, one, regularly extends, whether in connection with loans, sale of property or services or otherwise, consumer credit, which is payable by agreement in more than four installments or for which the payment of a finance charge is or may be required, and is the person from whom the debt arising is the original contracting person. So here under the Truth in Lending Act, and then what a credit sale is. A credit sale is one in which, and again, just like retail installment contract, there's a first sentence and then there's an includes clause afterward. It says the term includes any contract in the form of a bailment or lease, includes any, right, substantially equivalent to, and then the CFR has similar regulations, where credit sale means a sale in which the seller is a creditor, and then says the term includes a bailment or a lease, etc. So here we have the Truth in Lending Act, which different from our law, has a requirement of four or more payments, or if there's a finance charge. The distinction could be easily distinguished because in New Jersey is more favorable to the consumers because it only requires two or more. So if you pay in only one payment, there's no finance charge, and if you pay in two or more, there may or may not be a finance charge. But the federal government in the Truth in Lending Act said that it had to be four or more or a finance charge because you could have a payment with two payments or with three payments that may or may not, that may have a finance charge but doesn't include the four. And to just bring this argument home, and contrary to my colleague here on the Department of Banking and Insurance, we cited in our case to the Joseph versus Norman case, which is also a 1970s case that specifically regarded the sale of health club services. And in that decision, they dealt with a health club that was selling lifetime membership agreements for $360. They were actually financing those agreements over time, and they specifically had people sign a note that said 0% financing. So when they did that, the court there, after discovery, found out that that health club was selling those lifetime memberships to a finance company at a discount. And they found that that discount was the true cash price. And the true cash price, and that they weren't made the required disclosures under the Truth in Lending Act, and therefore, it, under the finance agreement part or the finance charge part, they didn't even get to the four payments. They found that that was a violation of TILA. So the absurd result is, under New Jersey law, if you actually find that a finance charge or a time price differential is required under the retail installment sales contract, you'll have the absurd result in New Jersey that a case will be dismissed on a motion to dismiss at the beginning of the case without it doing any discovery, where we might actually find out a finance charge was sold. Because who, what bank would buy a 0% financing agreement at the full price when they're not going to make any money at it? They have to buy at a discount because they have a cost of their money. Otherwise, they will go out of business. Another example I put for you is a used car dealer where they do buy here, pay here, which we've all heard of, and there's cases about that. You go in to buy a car, and it's advertised for $5,000 on the internet. You go in to buy it, and you say, well, I don't have $5,000. I want to pay it over time. And the car dealer says, well, if you want to pay it over time, I'll sell it to you for $6,000, and you pay me off every week that you get paid for the next 26 weeks. You'll pay me something. Well, that's a retail installment contract, and there's actually a finance charge that we will never, ever find out unless we get to do discovery to show that there was a different cash price and a time price differential that was hidden in the agreement.
So I think we understand your position about whether a financing agreement is required.
Can I just grab my water?
Of course. Can you explain under the facts here the concern, and I'm particularly interested in the interplay between the initiation fee and the time price differential, because they were told pay 24 months of installments and $29.99. Why is that unlawful?
Sure. It's actually unlawful for two reasons. One, under the definition of a retail installment contract, this was a 24-month agreement that there was an option to pay either upfront the whole 24 months, sure, or to pay it over time. That, under my initial argument, brings it into the realm of the Retail Installment Sales Act. That initiation fee is, both under my analysis and the Department of Banking Insurance, is a time price differential because of the definition of what a time price is. I'm not going to read it. You all know that. But in addition to that, regardless of whether it's a time price differential, it's a violation of Section 50 of the Retail Installment Sales Act, which that provision provides that no retail seller, sales finance company, or holder shall charge, contract for, collect, or receive from any retail buyer, directly or indirectly, any further or other amount for costs, charges, insurance premiums, examination, appraisal service, brokerage commission, expenses, interest, discount, retail discount, fees, fines, penalties, or other things in value in connection with the retail installment contracts or retail charge that are otherwise permitted, except certain things.
So you've read it, but interest is permissible, no? In a retail installment, as long as it's not usurious, and as long as it doesn't violate the statute. Am I mistaken?
No, you're not. In fact, in the previous cases, you've dealt with that. I believe it was either the Girard or the Turner case, you dealt with non-usurious interest rates. In Perez, you dealt with that.
And Section 41, and I'm hoping you can explain this. Section 41 explains time price differentials and imposes limits on rates. What is problematic within the construct of Section 41 about the $29.99 initiation fee?
Okay, I'll try to answer that. I cited that to show that a time price differential wasn't required because it said they're authorized to charge one, which is permissive and not mandatory. That's the reason that I said that. So what's unlawful is they didn't characterize it and they didn't give you the proper disclosures. Well, 41 doesn't talk about the initiation fee at all. 50 talks about it. And 50, I think...
If we were to deem the initiation fee a time price differential, okay, what would be problematic under 41?
Over 24 months.
Well, I don't think 41 is actually the section of retail so that would apply to that. I don't know, it would be allowed, but I think that these other sections, which I don't have in front of me now,
over 24.
That says that it was that you have to give proper disclosures. You have to give what the interest rate is, what the APR is, the finance charges. There's a whole list of things. I think it's A through H.
So you're not relying on that section.
I'm relying on that section for my initial argument to say that a finance charge isn't required. It's permissive.
Assume your client ended his relationship with this health club in 4 months instead of 24 months. Is that permissible?
Not under this contract. The contract requires him that he's responsible for the entire.
So isn't there something under RESA that doesn't permit acceleration clauses?
Well, there is. That's another provision of RESA.
I know. So I mean, you have various things going on over here.
We waived that argument. We made that in our complaint because our argument with that is because it doesn't apply to Mr. Sanchez. And after Spade came out, we had a TIQUINA claim based on that being a violation of RESA. But he paid all his payments, and then he ended it at the end. I agree with you, but we took that claim out of the complaint.
He went to 24 months?
He paid all 24 months.
Now, in a different circumstance, if under this contract, if someone went 4 months with the acceleration clause, that might be a violation. And then with 4 months, then the initiation fee, the interest rate against 4 months would be different than 24 months. But you don't have that case.
I don't have that case, but I agree that in that case, there would be actually a different ascertainable loss under the Consumer Fraud Act based on paying the full price of the contract under its terms, in violation of RESA if it applied. And in fact,
do we have to get to any of these issues? I've looked at your petition, so I'm trying to look at the simplest way for the court to resolve this issue. You have two issues. One is whether or not service is covered under the retail. And number two is whether or not the retail installment statute applies here. Those are the only two issues before us. We don't have to get to this time price differential and violations. Those are the only two issues that are raised in the petition. Am I mistaken? Am I missing something?
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. And the reason why I raised it in my opening statement is because I know your charge is to narrowly construe the case before you. I know that's what you did in Perez, which only applied to the sale of goods, and it didn't apply to services, and that's why I think the appellate division here and in Mellett was wrong, because it was only narrowly to do that. But I think based on that last sentence of that this isn't a true retail installment because of the financing agreement and the Department of Banking also agreeing with that position, that I think that it's important for clarity for businesses and consumers to know whether or not.
But you're here on a Rule 462 E
yes,
motion.
And
you're here on your view is the trial court threw it out on a motion to dismiss on the basis of a very broad reading, or broad or narrow as the case may be, reading of the statute that would exclude you. It sounds to me, and I was thinking the same thing as apparently Justice Alvin was thinking, it sounds to me that you would like us to find the defendant liable under RESA, or write something that suggests that the agreement violates RESA. That's not a Rule 462 issue.
That's what I'm not asking you on.
So you're asking for the basis for the trial court's dismissal on Rule 462 to be reviewed, and whatever other arguments there may be out there on your part saying they should be liable, on their part saying they should be not liable under the statutes, that's not before the court.
No, the ultimate issue is not before the court. It's whether or not we get to go back.
I'm just saying that the standard under a 463 motion is printing mark, court searches pleadings with liberality, and does not dismiss if there's a possible result regardless of the ultimate outcome. Isn't that basically you're saying that the court did not apply print and mark?
Yes, and came to this conclusion, but I was going further based on the appellate division decision to try and show, yes, the trial court, and yes, we're here to go back and litigate our case from the beginning.
To get back in the game, all you have to do is say, they were rendering a service, and the statute applies to them. Then the rest of it, then it's on you to prove that there's a violation. This is what Justice Patterson is saying.
I agree with that, and I believe it is a service because it's included in the statute. I believe that we properly allege that that the initiation fee is either a time price differential, not properly, or it is a improper fee under 50. And
that's something that you have to prove. That's not one of the. We don't have to.
No,
get
I'm saying that's what we allege in the complaint. I agree with you, and that we were improperly dismissed on the motion to dismiss.
And you'd probably like us to say that Mellett was incorrectly decided?
Well, Mellett is a Mellett is a published decision that says that no service contract applies. This case is unpublished and says it may apply under some circumstances if it's a true retail installment contract. It's unpublished. But yes, Mellett saying that it doesn't apply to any services, I believe, was incorrectly, and I think that this decision should if you agree with me, overturn the Mellett decision.
If we get you back in the game, I want to peek ahead nonetheless, based on something that came up in the reply brief to Toby's brief. If the cost of the lump sum payment here was actually the higher of the two options, is there a case?
Yes, and I'll explain why. So one, it's not in the record before the court, and that would be something that we would go back and
do. No,
it's
not in the record.
But hypothetically, assuming that's the case.
You know what your contract actually offered, I would assume.
Yeah, I have it right in front of me, Your Honor.
No, but that doesn't, the same document, it doesn't have the dollar figure. You know what the offer was, or no?
No, we only know that.
Do you have a case if the lump sum was higher, cost more?
Yes, I believe so, and I think if we get there, we'll make the argument. The argument is there were two options here. Our client was only offered the 24-month option, and we're only looking at the 24-month option that tells you what the price is for a credit transaction and multiplied, and that you have to pay this initiation fee with that price. It's two different options. I don't know the basis of a lump sum payment, whether there's other fees included in that lump sum payment and what that contract would ultimately look like. I can only go by what's here. And our class, as we have alleged, is only people who selected option, the second option in paragraph 4 of the contract, which
So that's a slightly different answer. You've said only people who selected the second option and that your client was only offered the second option.
Yeah, I think there's a fact that right now, I don't remember what the complaint says, and I don't think they've been proven, but I think ultimately, no matter what that first price is, if people opted for or sold, I think is irrelevant to our claim, because our claim concerns the people who bought.
So how can you prove an ascertainable loss under the CFA?
I'm sorry?
How could you prove an ascertainable loss under the CFA if the other option that your client wasn't given would be the more expensive option?
Because under a retail installment sales contract, that initiation fee is unlawful under Section 50, regardless of what more is. It's an unlawful act, and under Lamelado and the other standards, that and it's unlawful, and they can't charge it when they do it when it's a retail
installment. What's your ascertainable loss, your clients?
My client's is the $29.99, and that's what
so
we
he just
every class.
The option being he doesn't join this club, right? He would not have. Your theory is that by paying out the $29.99, he suffered a loss because he wouldn't have joined the club either way. It's not like he had a cheaper option.
That's not my argument, Your Honor. So my argument is that once they've made a retail installment sales contract, and they gave them an option to buy it over time and pay in two or more payments, they had to comply with the retail installment sales.
Has your class action been certified?
No, I said putative class at the beginning.
Okay,
that's it was dismissed on the pleadings. There's no class.
Class yet.
Right, there is no class. It's an alleged class. There's no case right now because it was dismissed.
You're just saying they couldn't charge the $29.99. My client was permitted and wanted to go to this health club for 20, 4 months. They just couldn't charge him that extra $29.99. That's your position.
Right. Under once it became a retail installment sales right. contract, that was an unlawful fee under Section 29 and under.
But the
$29.99 is under Section 50, regardless of what other prices might be available for different types of membership.
But to be clear, that issue isn't even before us.
No, correct? It is not. It's an ultimate issue in the case. If you let us go back to try and prove that,
right.
might come back to you again in a few years. But that's not.
We're looking forward to it.
yes.
But you're telling us, as represent, you're telling this court that in good faith there's a basis for this to proceed, because you are only offered option two.
That's my understanding, that what Mr. Sanchez, and that because it's a retail installment sales contract, there's a good faith basis to proceed, because that fee was not permitted under the retail installment sales.
Well, if, in your mind, if you didn't have a good faith basis, you're wasting your time before this court.
If I didn't feel I had a good faith basis, I would have never filed the complaint or taken Mr. Sanchez's case on in the first place.
Were there other grounds that they were there other grounds that the defendants asserted other than these two general arguments that you're here on as a basis for their 462E motion?
Yeah, well they've asserted that a health club contract, which is another point that I wanted to get to, so thank you for asking, is not a services contract. They've done it in our briefing, they did it in even response to Dobie in their last briefing, and they're saying it doesn't apply because it's not a service contract. And first of all, I'll go back to that Joseph case.
I'm not asking to address those because they're not before the court. But what I'm asking for is did the trial court actually decide all of the issues that the defendant presented on the motion to dismiss? For example, the one you just gave.
Dismissed the case in its entirety.
Okay, and did they decide a health, they said services are not in, but did the trial court decide this issue, it would seem illogical to do it, as to whether a health club is a services, is a health contract is a services contract. I'm trying to get at, are there issues left on the motion to dismiss that have been undecided?
I think the motion to dismiss was initially, there was a whole series of things. There was an initial motion to dismiss. The defendant, it was right when we went to e-court, the defendant didn't put the complaint in. The judge ruled on certain basis without seeing the complaint that were improper. Both sides filed kind of motions for reconsideration. And then ultimately on the motion for reconsideration, the judge just dismissed the entire complaint. I don't remember the exact grounds for that, but I really don't remember if he dealt with services. He dealt with the issues of whether certain provisions that we allege were violation of the Health Club Services Act were violations, like the total contract price being on the document and other provisions. But I don't remember if he actually said that it's not a service, a Health Club Services contract, that it's not a services contract.
Well, if you're talking about the trial court's ruling?
Yes, that's, I think, was the question.
Yeah. At least on page 18 of the transcript, it says, okay, the Mellett case, it really reinforces my prior ruling on the inapplicability of RESA. And I think one of the prime things is that there's no ownership of really anything in this type of health club contract. So RESA would not apply. Is that what you're referring to?
No, because that's the RESA argument. I thought Justice Patterson's question was about whether or not he dealt with the issue of whether it was a services contract.
I'm just asking, is there something undecided out there? Are there issues undecided by the trial court? That was my question.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, it wasn't very clear.
Yeah. I think he agreed that it didn't apply because, yeah, so I guess, Your Honor, not applying to RESA for that reason would also mean that a service contract is not included. And so that would actually cover the question. So he by relying on Mellett, he did rely on the fact that it's not covered.
That's how I read it.
Yeah, I agree with you. So yes, that is another issue. Again, that's an issue that's not decided. You don't have to decide, but the statute that regulates health clubs is actually called the Health Club Services Act, and they define what my client bought as actually health club services. So they mm-hmm. use the term services throughout, which is not before you, but would be an ultimate issue as to whether or not the service applies.
Anything you'd like to add before we break?
At this time, no, if you don't have any other questions.
I'll add just one thing so that you don't misinterpret, you don't misread anything into my earlier question about good faith. I wasn't suggesting the opposite. It's a bit puzzling to me as I read, you know, your adversary's brief, that the lump sum contract cost $1,198 and the contract that your client signed was less than $1,000 when we're talking about a consumer protection statute. But that's to be hammered out down the road. We understand that. It's not on the record right now. I was accepting your good faith representation, and that's why I phrased it that way.
No, I appreciate that, Your Honor. Yes, we didn't have that information. We haven't gotten to do any discovery. What that legal argument and what the facts turn out to be,
yeah.
We'll see what happens in the future.
Thank you.